Mini episode 84 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by DOU Productions, delivering coverage of sports and pop culture through columns, live blogs, and original videos. Follow them on the web at generationchatter.blogspot.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Okay, everybody, welcome. It's FDH Lounge mini episode number 84. Rick Morris and Kyle Ross, your FDH Lounge dignitaries here today, kicking off a very special nine-part project that Kyle has conceptualized, the history of WrestleMania. Kyle, props to you. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it'll be so easy. It's going to be, I mean, I've done things like, you know, last year, I did something similar, right? But it was, in written form.
Written form,
this
yes.
time, you know, it'll be cool to interact with you, talking about the stuff, going over what worked, what didn't. You know, this is something I could do, you know, any day of the week, you know.
Yeah.
Love doing it, love talking about it, really looking forward to it. And taking the time, you know, I've done this on previous shows before, you know,
the old SNS. Also, yeah.
But I really think we're going to have time to let everything breathe here. It's not going to be condensed, and we're going to have a lot of fun.
Oh, it's going to be tremendous. We're going to do here in part one today, WrestleMania's 1 and 2. And we'll continue to serialize this as we go through leading up through the WrestleMania season. But 1 and 2 here today, the original ones, and of course, March 31st, 1985, kicking it all off. There had been, as we know, super shows previously. There had been two Starcades in the books by this time. There had been other shows. Actually, I mean, you and I, for guys that grew up in Cleveland, there was a Cleveland Stadium card in 1972 that I think the NWF and some other groups put together. I don't think it was anybody that was really household names, if you will.
I mean, you're fishing here, buddy. I mean,
Well, there were the Shea shows. Those are pretty big. Yeah. 72,
Texas
76,
Stadium.
And 80.
Texas Stadium in 84 with Flair and Von Erich headlining.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, previous Texas Stadium ones as well. I think 1982 with one of Fritz's phantom retirements on that show. So there had been other ones. But, yeah, this was one where Vince was going much bigger. He was taking it nationwide via closed circuit. There were copious use of movie theaters and the like, such as there had been for big Muhammad Ali fights over the years. And this was Vince's vision. So I guess we'll start there with how he wanted to use this thing to help take his promotion nationwide and to differentiate from what the other guys were doing, Kyle.
Well, yeah, it was a huge risk at the time. You know, now it's kind of known that this was basically, he swung for the fences with this show. If this show had not worked, I don't know what wrestling would look like today at all.
Probably would have just receded back into the Northeast. He still had that.
Yeah, he would have, but he certainly would be a lot different. You know, I mean, in 1985, the landscape for people around, it was still largely competitive. I mean, you know,
sure.
They were definitely inching ahead of everyone. And inching, I think, is not giving them enough credit. You know, they were pulling ahead of the other promotions by 1985.
They were a little over a year by the spring of 85 into the national expansion. They'd been going into the old AWA markets and other places
like that.
Yeah,
the AWA was obviously hurting badly by 85. The NWA was still doing very well.
Right.
The NWA was still doing very well. I mean, you know, some of its, you know, territories, very, you know, Watts kind of started to have a downturn with the economy.
Yeah.
A World Class had already seen its, you know, pinnacle in 83, 84.
Right.
Yeah, I think the Freebirds left at some point in 85.
Right.
So, it was a huge risk. Nothing like that had been before. It's not a pay-per-view event. It is closed circuit. And the hype, I mean, the hype for it, it really was, they put all their eggs in one basket for this show. Had it not succeeded, you know, who knows how much of it's hyperbole. We don't know what would have happened to the company. But the bottom line is it did work, set the stage for, you know, the last now almost 30 years of doing this. And but for me, with the first one, where it fits in, it's a show that has largely been free of scorn, I think. And there is nothing bad per se on it, but I've always said that this show is a glorified house show with a big time celebrity main event. Mr. T was huge.
Right.
You know, for people who weren't around then and, you know, just kind of knows Mr. T is kind of his novelty act or whatever. You know, he does commercials and kind of, you know, makes fun of himself.
Right.
He was a big deal in 1985.
He was.
And if you, it's from a wrestling perspective, there's not a lot to sneeze at on this show. I mean, that's the best match on the show.
Well,
with Hulk Hogan as Mr. T as your babyface team.
Here's the other thing, too, because you had sent me your initial production notes here, and I've been looking them over. The other thing, I hadn't really thought about this before. I found that I did agree with you when I looked at it and that there wasn't a lot that was based on existing programs. For example, we'll talk about Tito Santana in a moment, but if they were doing a program-oriented thing, you would have put him in there with Greg Valentine and had the blow-off.
Well, you have to remember that in 1985, the house shows
still
mattered.
Yes.
For people, you know, the younger fans that are listening to this, they probably can't even wrap their head around that.
Right.
That, you know, you know, WrestleMania is obviously, even though when looking way down the line, when we talk about the more recent WrestleManias, I'm going to criticize them heavily because they really don't do this as well anymore, blow off, you know, long angles and long, because they just don't do that anymore, Ricky.
Right.
But that's a different topic for a different day. But with this show, at least early on, they didn't do that. You know, they didn't have really, I mean, there were some feuds settled here. You know, Andre and Stud had their
issue. See, that's the thing, and I wanted to bring that up, actually, because to me, that was kind of like the semi-main, and that was the one example there. So I ever so slightly disagree with you, because I think there was two.
But even then, though, it was a gimmicky match, though,
right,
where, you know, you didn't know. I mean,
but it was the body slam.
He slammed him.
Yeah, but it was a whole buildup. Nobody can slam me. Nobody, not even Andre. So in a sense, it was. But you're right, though. I mean, it wasn't a complete blow off because Andre would continue to have interactions with the Heenan family, Stud included, until
Bundy,
he joined them.
He worked against Bundy largely for the second half of '85. But there were a lot of tag matches.
Yes.
Like, there's a Saturday Night's Main Event. One of the first ones is main evented by either the second or the third one's main evented by Hogan and Andre against Bud and Stud.
Right.
Bundy and Stud, pardon me, as I get the toilet paper out of my mouth. But, with the Santana Valentine, though, they headlined house shows over the summer.
Right,
And Santana was coming up. They'd done a big injury angle where Valentine had won the title late in '84.
Right.
Santana came back, and you're right. So
They were headlining the B shows.
Yeah, the undercard for this, though, leaves. I mean, there were some. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, what you expect now out of a big show.
Oh,
is much different than what people. I mean, there's like you said, you had both Hogan and Andre on the same card here. You had a title change,
right?
I mean, you know, in 1985, that was kind of a lot. That was a big deal. But ultimately, with WrestleMania 1, Ricky, if I were, I always think about this. If I were to divide, you know, to rank them all or whatever, this is like in the bottom group at the time. It's not the worst. I mean, because it's but. When was the last time you were like, you know what I really want to watch right now is WrestleMania 1? You know, it's a show. And part of it for me personally is I was not watching at the time. I was still relatively young when I was 4 years old when this show happened. So I was not watching WWE. I did not come until WrestleMania 3.
Okay.
So, you know, I didn't watch. So I don't, the buildup for this show, it just isn't a part of, you know, my DNA.
Didn't,
you know, by the time I started watching wrestling, this show had come and gone. It was 2 years old.
Right.
So, you know, for me, that kind of hurts it. But, yeah, it's a glorified house show, I think, with a celebrity main event. That's the term I was
using. Well, that and then, you know, like I said also, you know, Andre and Stud, you know, we could make a case on that. But you're absolutely right, though, on the part about Tito Santana and Valentine, because what they were doing on this, and I find this to be fascinating when you're looking at the business strategy of this, because this was make or break, but they didn't treat it that way in terms of loading it up with blow-offs. They wanted to hook you in so you would go to the house shows and so you would order subsequent closed circuits and then pay-per-views. So you had on the show, not in big matches against one another, King Kong Bundy, he was up against SD Jones. Tito Santana up against the Executioner. We'll talk about that in a minute. Ricky Steamboat against Rick Bourne. David Sammartino, Brutus Beefcake. The fathers were the corner men.
Yeah.
So that was a gimmick.
Yeah, but, you know, largely that's what you get on the house shows. You had the first half of the show, all it was stuff to put, you know, just put a guy over really clean that they were going to push. You know, Santana goes over Bundy, Steamboat. The Sammartino, they tried to do something. David Sammartino was just so bad that it didn't work. But those first three matches, all those were just, I mean, those were basically they were extended job matches.
Well, sure, but also JYD against Greg Valentine for the Intercontinental title. Again, it was a thing of Greg Valentine, we're not going to put him in there in the marquee feud that he's carrying on versus Tito Santana, but we got to put him in there with another guy.
And JYD was
very
over.
He was
very
over, but that's kind of my point about this, is that Vince McMahon and his people knew that there were names that the public was going to expect to see on this show. Whether the ones that were there, the ones that to the smarter fans of the day that they'd seen in other territories like Greg Valentine, they knew who had to be on the show. They just didn't want to make the show something that would come off as the end-all, be-all to where, okay, I don't have to go to a house show the rest of the year because I've seen the climax of every feud. You mentioned a title match here, the title change. Barry Windham, Mike Rotundo losing the WWF tag team titles to Nikolai Volkoff and the Iron Sheik. That was the other one on here. Another example, somewhat of an ongoing program, Wendy Ripker with Cindy Lauper in her corner against
kind of
Lovani Kai.
This was a glorified house show.
Yes, glorified. Fundamentally, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, this is much better than – I mean, I don't mean to demean the show at all. It was a house show called WrestleMania because
it was kind of a throwaway as far on the undercard.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't trying to hook people with the undercard, not by any stretch.
No, people like you and me – probably focus on that a lot more than most. I think about that. You got to remember that ultimately, at the end of the day, he was trying to take his product to a new audience. I know he always talks about this, and a lot of people roll their eyes with
right.
it. But the only match that really mattered on this show was the main event. Nothing else. And to be honest with you, the women's match was probably second in terms of public intrigue with the Cyndi Lauper involvement and stuff like that. I mean, you know,
the Geraldine Ferraro thing when they hooked her into making a comment.
Well, yeah, that was
that was funny.
Yeah. But that was good. But you know, other than that, I mean, celebrities was obviously a big part of this. Like introducing celebrities to, has always been a big part of WrestleMania.
You're right that the Lauper thing might have been the second biggest one because it harkened back to Wendy Richter beating Fabulous Moolah on MTV the previous summer after 28 years or whatever it was on top. Because Cyndi Lauper was there at the genesis of the Rock and Wrestling Connection, which is the big thing they used to put this in the mainstream with Hulk Hogan and everything else like that. So by that time, it had splintered. And let us not forget, at the war to settle the score, I believe that Mr. T was ostensibly coming to the defense of Cyndi Lauper when he entered the ring there. Was he not? Wasn't she getting involved on Hogan's behalf, I think?
No.
Am I remembering that wrong?
I'm trying to think here. No, they were just calling him out.
Yeah,
it was a situation where Hogan was being double or triple teamed, and they were kind of calling.
I thought maybe Piper was making a move like he was going to hit Cyndi Lauper.
Maybe one of us is remembering that wrong,
and I have no idea. Okay. It might very well be me.
I could picture him kind of getting all, Mr. T getting all fired up at ringside and kind of coming face to face. But you're right. I can't. Shame on me. The specific.
I don't remember either. You know, but it's a thing where. When you look at the undercard, and again, like you said, putting guys over, King Kong Bundy, the thing with S.D. Jones.
Yeah, it was a fake. They set a fake record, but Bundy.
Yeah, nine seconds.
Yeah, they had big plans for him. I mean, obviously, he headlined next year's WrestleMania.
Yeah, the funny thing is, the WrestleMania that he headlined, they didn't call it that back in the day. But at WrestleManias 1 and 3, he had what we would today call WrestleMania moments. The S.D. Jones squash in 9 seconds and squashing the midgets at 3. That's the funny thing. And in between, he headlined WrestleMania.
Yeah, in between, he headlined, and they had big plans. He was pushed huge throughout 85. You know, I mean, he had the five-count gimmick and stuff like that. And, and Steamboat was playing Santana, obviously. You know, it was his first match back, and he wins back the Intercontinental title, obviously. You know, today, you're right. Today's marketplace, he probably wins the title at this show.
Right.
But, you know, the idea of two title changes at the same show,
right.
you know, was crazy back then. You never, I mean, title changes were so rare, you know, back in that time. So, like, anytime it was a big deal. So to have two on the same show, that was just something that didn't happen.
Well, in the age of kayfabe, when there's cards night after night after night, you don't want the marks thinking too hard. My gosh, what's the chances of two title title changes on one show? Yeah, you didn't want people thinking too hard about that. We had two questions here about one from our senior producer, Steve Servillo.
Uh-oh.
One was, and I think we can dismiss this one pretty easily, because he mentioned about how Hart Foundation, Bulldogs weren't on the card, and what's up with that? How come they didn't even do a battle royal? I think we already touched on that. You didn't need a battle royal for the undercard, and that's like 2020 hindsight, I think, because these guys weren't that big at the time, and the show wasn't about establishing new talent.
I don't think the Bulldogs were had been on TV yet.
I don't think they had. Foundation had, I think.
No.
They hadn't?
Separately. They were not a team yet, I don't think.
Okay.
I think both things happened. I'm almost positive, if I remember my 85 championship wrestling set correctly,
okay,
that the Bulldogs debuted very shortly after WrestleMania. Like,
right.
it may have been actually the Cindy after
the
show. It was so people in MSU, they wouldn't have, no one would have known. Now, look, they got over really quick.
Right.
To a very high degree. But the Harts, no, because I remember in commentary on the show, they talk about how Jimmy Hart was putting a stable. He had Jim Neidhart. There was no reference of Bret Hart. The Harts were not a team yet at this point.
Well,
I'm positive.
Regardless of that, again, yeah, I mean, I think Steve's whole thing, I think it's 2020 hindsight, because we talked about the names you had to have on the undercard, and again, they weren't trying to put together a strong undercard of matches against one another. But you had to have the names in the mix. Bundy, Steamboat, JYD, Valentine, Sheik and Volkoff, Rotundo and Windham, Andre, Stud, if you consider that to be undercard. Those are the names you needed. You didn't need any of the other guys.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the idea of, you know, kind of what we know now as kind of, you know, the token throw-in to please the smart fans.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Hey, we'll give a good match to shut them up. That concept did not exist in 1985.
No, it didn't.
There were not a lot of good matches at all during
this time period.
I mean, the snowflakes were not falling in 1985 WWF.
No, they were not.
There were some good matches in the house show. I shouldn't be
There were some decent ones, and we'll talk about one of them at two here, because there's one that you've put over as being stronger than I remembered it, so we'll talk about that with two.
Okay.
We'll talk about that one there, Hoss, but
that's a good match.
Well,
I can't wait to say that's a good match.
Okay.
I may pop that in the old VCR.
Nice.
That's a good match.
We may have to do that here.
That's a good match.
The funny thing is, you talked about squashes. This one was an extended squash, and it leads to Steve's second question. Tito Santana defeating the Executioner in 4 minutes and 50 seconds. His question was, how come Buddy Rose was there under a mask? You and I talked about this a shade off the air, and I think we kind of settled it as far as you needed a good worker, you needed a masked guy. I'm pretty sure Bill Eadie had moved on by 85.
Yeah.
So he wasn't around. They basically, again, for the Nouveau fans and for the fans who were returning to the product of wrestling who'd been away, they wanted to show him a masked guy because that's part of the culture. And they wanted a good worker, which Buddy Rose certainly was. Buddy Rose was working other places at the time, so it couldn't be him.
He was working
in
Oregon. And,
you know,
I think he was in, or he was headed to the AWA shortly after this. I don't think, because all those matches were in 86.
Yeah.
When it was Rose and Summers against, Michaels and Jannetty.
Exactly.
Those were all over the course of 86. So he was, headed there. So, he still mattered a little bit to some people.
Well, he did, and he was a pretty good draw in the AWA in Portland and in those areas. And I'd said to you off air, in some ways it would almost have been a waste even if they could have used him under his own name. You just need the Executioner out there. You don't need Buddy Rose. It's not like Buddy Rose is going to, make any more
pies. Cup of coffee. Yeah, no, you're right. He wouldn't have been a waste to use his name. They just wanted to, and they tried. It was a real half-hearted push. I think it was the only appearance.
Well, yeah, exactly.
With this gimmick they ever did. And it was one of those things just had some intrigue and have, some novelty there. But
good worker under a mask. I don't think it gets any more complicated than that. But I said, it ties back to the whole philosophy of building the undercard and how the undercard in this thing was to be done a certain way, not too larded up with things that were going to kill the house shows subsequently. Then, of course, it comes to the main event. And people tend not to remember, people remember Bob Orton as being the corner man for Piper and Orndorff because he was very well tied into the angle, and he ended up playing into the finish here with clobbering Orndorff with the cast. It's less remembered because Hogan and T did most of their media appearances just solo, if you will, just the two of them. Jimmy Snuka, the corner man. So this served as sort of the blow-off of the Snuka-Piper feud as well.
Yeah, Snuka,
to the extent that there was a blow-off, which there never really was.
Yeah, well, if some of the old Coliseum tapes, I think they did some. But again,
maybe only at the house show
level. What we have come to understand as a blow-off, there was nothing
on
in that
TV,
sense.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
For that. But they didn't like to do that back then because, you know, when you blow something off in front of everybody, it kind of kills the one guy, you know what I'm saying? So they didn't like to do it. But, yeah, Snuka here, if memory serves me correct, this was kind of a he was kind of a token throw-in here.
Yeah.
Because he was the number two guy on the babyface side behind Hogan for a lot of 84.
Yeah.
You know, quite. He had some issues.
Him and Slaughter were both jockeying for that spot. Neither one of them wanted to be second banana to Hogan, and that's part of the reason neither one of them lasted that long.
Well, yeah, and then Jimmy had his fair share of issues.
Yeah.
Legally. You know,
allegedly, something about a woman's head in a wall.
Yeah. And then he had the drug issues too.
Yes.
Yeah, and he had actually been taken off TV for a decent period of time before this show.
It's interesting too. I mean, when you see him on TV subsequently, I met him in person in '96. A bowling buddy of mine was promoting indie wrestling in the Lorain area. And because I owned a tux, I was invited to be his ring announcer. So I was there backstage, got to meet. Like, how you doing, brother? I mean, you talk about living the gimmick as far as, you know, the simple Islander and everything as far as how he presented himself.
And I don't think he pretty much disappeared after this, too.
Yeah.
Until 89.
This was his last hurrah during this run. By the way, too, and you'll like this, his traveling partner at the time in 96 and who he wrestled a lot of matches against, a young protege of his, behind-the-scenes protege, named the Metal Maniac. And this guy was, and he would wrestle Metal Maniac at all these shows. So I was there. I think the show I met him at, I was also working on the ring program at the time. I was putting together the program for the next show, and I was gathering material, and I was backstage. This Metal Maniac, in character, is haranguing me about, hey, brother, I don't know if he called me brother or not, but anyways, hey, I want you to tell me why I didn't win Rookie of the Year from PWI in 1992. That crooked Bill after, he said,
this did not
happen. He said, I lost it to the Super Destroyer. I think it was Super Destroyer. That was Hercules Hernandez under a mask. He shouldn't have been eligible to win Rookie of the Year. This guy's haranguing me, and I was like, I have no connection to PWI. I just work for my friend here who's doing a promotion. I want you to tell Bill after the next time you see him.
This didn't happen.
This totally
this
happened.
This did not
this
happen.
This totally happened.
That did not happen.
It did. I swear to God, I wish I had an eyewitness. It did not happen. It's not as great as at the previous show when I had a wrestler chasing me around the ring because I was doing the babyface ring announcer gimmick and getting fans to chant things into the mic at him. That was even better. I'll tell you about that off air.
Oh, that's good. I didn't know about this. Why didn't you tell me about that?
Yeah, some things are better sprung on the air, actually. But, this main event here, again, you talked about it that the work rate was probably, I mean, if you want to call it a work rate.
Yeah, I mean, this gets the match of the night. This is the best match of the night.
This had great work rate in the sense that, like, Hogan Rock at WrestleMania 18 did. It was the atmospherics. It was everything about it. It was the crowd being into it. It was not a great display of,
no, it was not good,
you know,
technical
run. No Hurricane Rana.
Yeah, I mean, given the four guys that were in it, I mean,
yeah.
Well, I mean, it speaks volumes when Hulk Hogan and Mr. T are your babyface team, and it's the match of the night.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're not getting a lot of, I mean, and there was obviously a good deal of controversy that's come out that T got some kind of cold feet
right
before the match, and Hogan and Piper really had to convince him, hey, you can't
right
chicken out now.
Right. Oh, it would have been absolutely
that
a disaster.
Yeah, that would have killed the company.
Yeah, right, well, it would have killed his own career. It would have killed everything. But in a match where
well, the great irony was is after the show, his career pretty much went in the toilet anyway.
Oh, it did.
By the next year at WrestleMania, no one cared anymore.
It did. And there is no better illustration of how inversely important work rate was to the success of the match than the fact that by far the number one worker in the match, a damn good worker, Paul Orndorff, was by far the least talked about of the four individuals going into this.
I mean, he did.
It was Hogan, Piper, and T.
He did cut several racist promos.
He
I love it. Mr. T.
Calling him boy?
Yeah,
holy crap. Yeah, yeah. You watch that through 2012 eyes, and they're just bulging out of your head.
Yeah, you're right. He was kind of...
But a great worker.
He
great.
Was. I mean, this was not his most famous heel run either. You know, for him, the big thing was the finish, how he wound up turning babyface in subsequent weeks after the show, obviously becoming friends with Hogan, and then, you know, did the huge heel turn on him the following year.
Right.
Which, you know, was the best run of his career. But yeah, he's kind of the forgotten man in this. I mean, obviously, you know, T's the celebrity, Hogan and Piper, two of the all-time biggest names. You know, and they were the two that, you know, were feuding at the time. That was the hot program in the company. Piper, incredible on the mic. I mean, you really, I mean, because he's become such a sad caricature of his former self, I think. You know, it's amazing. Because I watched some of these shows before we did this, just to pick up a few things. It's amazing how I mean, he, and it did wind up happening anyway, but you know, kind of today when a heel gets so good and he's kind of cool that they are kind of forced to turn a babyface?
Yeah.
It happened with Piper, but it would have happened much quicker. You know, I mean, in today's, like, I'm watching, I'm like, God, this is
well, he didn't
today.
Back down that much. I mean, like, at the war to settle the score, he was standing in there with Hogan in the ring, and that was just what was jarring, because this is a company that, especially in the modern age, has been built on the heel showing ass and the heel backing down. Roddy Piper didn't back down.
And he cut those unbelievable promos. I mean, again, kind of telling some lines there, but I mean, he cut unbelievable. I mean, it was kind of funny because usually people are very complimentary and they're careful not to go past a certain line when a celebrity's brought in, because the celebrity is kind of doing you a favor.
Sure.
He's getting some extra eyes that probably wouldn't care. So people are, you know, usually don't. You know, there have obviously been major instances of this not being true, but he really went at T, and it was good. They didn't like each other. I mean, that's not made up. They did not like each other at all. And that dynamic worked pretty well. I mean, they had that, you know, kind of moving ahead. I mean, they had that
That'll
terrible,
be our segue probably,
I mean, they had that terrible worked boxing match at WrestleMania 2. But, yeah, I mean, this was exactly what he'd be, and we didn't even bring up Muhammad Ali.
Ali was a part of this. Liberace with the
Billy Martin,
The Rockettes. Where I mean, just anybody and everybody. I think I don't know if Andy Warhol was still a part of it. Andy Warhol was, I think, at the war to settle the score. I don't remember if
he
was
at this. He wasn't there for this yet.
Okay,
and then
but
Pat Patterson was actually the in-ring referee. It was kind of funny. They had intended all along for Ali to be the referee in the ring, and it just came, and they're like, we can't have this. You know, he obviously was nowhere near, like,
I think
where
he'd already been
now.
Diagnosed with Parkinson's,
he
though.
He had, and I mean, the downward, you know, turn had kind of come, but it was nowhere near what it is today, obviously.
Right.
I mean, this was, and we're talking about 20 years ago.
Right.
But it was to a point where I think Patterson stepped in, if I remember correctly, and told McMahon, he's like, this guy can't. I mean, he can't be a referee. It'll be terrible. I mean, we can't have. I mean, say what you will about a referee. Obviously, you just want him to be a background. You don't want to, you know, no one pays attention, really. But he has to do, you know, a competent job.
Right.
And they kind of were like, whoa, I don't think we can count on him to do that.
No. You're responsible for time cues. You're responsible for a number of different things in there with helping to direct traffic when you're the referee. He was not going to be.
Yeah, and they threw him a spot. You know, the things kind of got out of hand, and, you know, he, you know, kind of backed, you know, Orton down or something. So, I mean, they threw the token stuff in there for him. So
it worked on that level, and it was as we conclude on one, it was, I thought, it was a brilliant finish because, again, it was a thing where
It led somewhere.
It gave Paul Orndorff a pretty hot babyface run in 85. It was a way to beat that team without the number one thing you could not do going forward would be to drain the heat off of Roddy Piper. You had to have
Orndorff was pretty much in there to do the job.
Yes.
But at the same time, they did it in a way to see.
Yes.
This is going to be a big theme in these early ones. They did such a better job in these days. You can talk about how the wrestling was so much the in-ring product.
Right.
Doesn't compare. And you know, the production of it. But here's another thing, too. When you look at, you know, Vince will probably smile somewhere that I would say this. But when you look at the production of these first two WrestleManias, it's night and day compared. I mean, certainly compared to what they do today. I mean, that's not fair to even compare it. But
visually, it was like a bridge between the real old days and where we are now.
Yeah, because it was still that dark backdrop. You couldn't see the crowd. I mean, I've always said, I think I said in my production, they didn't get WrestleMania right till the third one.
Well, a part of it was, and this, listening to some old SNSs to get ready for this thing, you and the little guy talking about the influence on the promotion of Dick Ebersol, Saturday night's main event, everything they internalized from him, from the lighting to all aspects of production. I'm a little surprised it didn't manifest itself at 2, but certainly by 3 it did.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the first Saturday's main event was about 2 months after this show.
If the second one had been at one venue, maybe it would have been. Yeah, but it at 3.
We'll talk about that momentarily here. But, they did such a better job of keeping guys over in this period. It's like, okay, they lost. But
it didn't destroy Piper.
It satisfied the fans, and everyone came out of it okay. You know,
right.
Piper was still red hot as a heel.
Yeah.
Orndorff, okay, he loses, but it was, you know, it was the, they screwed it up. Orton hits one. They didn't, I mean, you know.
Right.
Kayfabe, they screwed it up.
Sure.
You know, so Orndorff, okay, he's going to turn babyface out. It's a good way to keep him over. Hogan and T, you know, they win, so they're still over.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it was done in a way that, you know, everyone came out of it looking okay, and the promotion looked great out of it. And this show is a success. Is obviously an unqualified success. That said, 3-17, clearly the two best WrestleManias. If I were to break the remaining 25 down into five groups of five, this isn't the last group of five.
It probably is.
It's certainly one of the bottom. It's one of the hardest for me to rank because it's such a success. Yet, for me, it's not a show that I ever have any yearning to put on. And Grant, that shouldn't be your basis for rating shows. But
that's the thing too. I mean, everything you're saying is right, and yet this is the perfect example of Vince accomplishing what he wanted to. Vince McMahon did not put this show together saying, I hope Kyle Ross in a time capsule in 2012 wants to see
and
it.
And that's what people you know, myself need to realize with these things. You know,
I mean, he wasn't trying to accomplish that.
No.
And he did not exceed his very modest expectations
in that
regard.
I think this concept, and just we'll leave it at this, is really interesting when you talk about a show that was a commercial success, but and this is even more so, but is critically kind of panned. And this show is not critically panned. Everyone agrees this show worked. You know, but people to say it's great or one of the best WrestleManias or anything, that's like, you know, these hip. I joke with the off air. It's like one of these hipsters, like, telling you how great this influence of a much more famous band is. It's
right.
Like, oh, you know, Bauhaus, they're so great. You know, they influenced Nine Inch Nails. It's like, okay, that's interesting. Nine Inch Nails is 20 times better.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But, you know, the show worked, and you're right. That was a great point you made about no wrestling show is ever should be done. So that, you know, 20 years later, I can speak glowingly about it.
I think there are some where when they're really in a groove where they know it can be an epic and they know it can stand the test of time.
We'll talk about that with 3, but
17 also.
Yeah,
17 stands the test
I'll tell
of
you
time.
What, those are external forces in play.
Yeah.
That's nothing they do.
And that was during the hot periods.
You cannot sit down and say, let's book a show right now that 20 years from now. They'll talk. There have to be big names in play.
Sure.
I mean, and granted, they do have some control over that.
Right.
I mean, but still, to me, this is. I'd say there are 10 WrestleManias that are below average.
Okay.
And this is certainly one of them. And when we talk about 4 and 5 moving forward, that's really going to illustrate the point of a show: commercial success, critically not well received.
Yeah, that's very true.